Well, good morning. All right, we are in Genesis chapter 17 today, Genesis 17. And we're going to try to make our way through a good portion of Scripture today. Again, we're just giving an overview of Genesis at this point to help us give the structure of it so that you can better study it on your own. Now, in Genesis 17, we have the covenant with Abraham that is renewed. We read in Genesis 17:1, when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him and said, "I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless, that I may make my covenant between you and me and may multiply you greatly." Abraham, of course, worships God, and God then renews the covenant with him. Also, in this text, we have Abram's name changed to Abraham from here on out in the narrative. Now, letter A, when we think about this text here, this chapter is not a new covenant made with Abraham. Rather, it is a renewal of the covenant. It's a renewal of the covenant, which I've already mentioned. The covenant was sworn with Abraham back in chapter 15. We'll see this in a little bit, but it was anticipated in Genesis 12, cut or sworn in Genesis 15, and it's renewed here in Genesis 17. And the fact that it needs to be renewed in context makes a lot of sense. Ishmael has been born at this point. And Abram is now 99 years old. And so the challenge of seeing how God's blessings in the covenant that would be poured out upon Abram are great. I mean, how is God going to actually work this out? Well, God reaffirms, he renews his covenant with Abraham, or Abram at this point. And so letter C, we read there that God had already told that Abram would be the father of many. That is reaffirmed three times in, it should read chapter 17 there. That is reaffirmed three times in chapter 17 with the statement that God would multiply you exceedingly. Now, you think about the significance of that. He's now 99 years old. This is what God's going to do for you. The change of Abram's name to Abraham reflects this reiterated promise. Abram means father is exalted. That's what the name means. Father is exalted. Whereas Abraham means father of a multitude. And again, you got to think about how significant this is in the life of Abram at this point, now Abraham. You know, Abram's 99 years old. He has one son, and sons were the key. In fact, only one child, but specifically sons were the key to be able to extend your lineage, your genealogy. And that son wasn't even through his wife, his first wife. It was through his concubine, Hagar. And so this is a serious promise of God and a challenging one to believe. We also see that God still bestows greatness upon Abraham. Abraham's greatness is demonstrated in that kings would come from him. We're told that here in this text. Sarai also receives a name change. It's interesting, both Sarai and Sarah mean the same thing, which is princess. Sarai's name change, though, emphasizes the royal status conferred upon her. Great kings would come from her. Now, in this covenant, God not only grants this covenant to Abraham, but also to his descendants. But it is interesting here, and this is very significant in Genesis chapter 17, that God specifically says where the blessing of his covenant would lie. And it would lie not with Ishmael in verses 20 and 21, but rather with Isaac. Notice this, verse 20. "As for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him, and I will make him fruitful and multiply him greatly. He shall father 12 princes, and I will make him into a great nation. But, here's the key, I will establish my covenant with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this time next year. Stunning promise here. And that would have been very significant because if you do the math, I mean, Ishmael here is, you know, roughly 13 years old at this point. And I'm sure in Abraham's mind, you know, he was the guy. And God says, no, he is not the guy. So you're 99 years old and you're being told you're going to be the father of many. All right. The father of many is going to come from your wife, who's 10 years younger than you. She's 89. All right. This was a big deal, what God says to him here. There is a sign of this covenant, and that is of circumcision. Remember that in covenants, we've emphasized this, that the key to enacting the covenant is when the oath would be sworn. This is what I will do. I promise to do this. But there were many other things or symbols or sometimes sacrifices that went around covenants. And here we have a sign, or sometimes you'll see people talk about a symbol, or another word you might see or hear people talk about is a token of the covenant. Right? This is a sign of the covenant. And the sign was of circumcision. And this particular sign had four provisions. First of all, according to verse 12, all males born in the household and those brought into the household are to be circumcised. Second, it is the sign of the covenant between God and Abraham, in verse 11. Third, it is to be observed perpetually. And fourth, for a male to not be circumcised is to break God's covenant and to be cut off from his people. This is also one of the reasons why, when we talked about covenants a few weeks ago, that I mentioned that a lot of Bible teachers will use the term unconditional covenant. I'm not against that term. I know what they're trying to get at, but it's not my favorite term because there are, even in these gracious covenants, conditions that are given. So I like the term unilateral covenant here. It's from God in this case, from God the superior to the lesser, but it's all about blessing. Okay. It's not about, okay, let's make a deal here. You do this for me and I'll do this for you. It's not like that. It's a blessing, and you want these blessings. This is what you're going to do to reflect my rule and my power. Also, we've mentioned this just a little bit, but it's worth noting here formally the structure of the presentation of God's covenant with Abraham and the structure of the covenant with Israel in Exodus. And I don't think this would have been lost on the original readers. With Abraham, as I mentioned, the covenant was anticipated in Genesis 12. I'm going to make my covenant with you. It is cut, or the oath is given, in Genesis 15. It is renewed in Genesis 17. We actually see the exact same pattern with the people of Israel when you get to Exodus. Remember that Genesis is part of five books, the five scrolls, the Torah, the Pentateuch. And so the people of Israel, they would have had the same thing. It was anticipated in Exodus 19, and that's when they're getting ready at Mount Sinai. It is actually cut in Exodus 24. There's a formal covenant that is made there, and it is renewed with the people of Israel in Deuteronomy 29, right before they were to cross over into the land of promise. I don't think that's insignificant because here we have, this is right before the promised son is going to be delivered. It was also renewed with Israel right before the promised land was going to be taken by them. So Moses is constructing this carefully and recounting this history to see that. In between each of these covenants, these covenant movements, the reader sees both the successes of Abraham and Israel and also their failures. So if you read through Genesis 12 all the way through the renewal of the covenant in Genesis 17, you say, you know, good Abraham, bad Abraham, good Abraham, bad Abraham, all right? It's back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. The same is true with the people of Israel. But in all of it, God's faithfulness is there. I promised you I'd give you my covenant. I gave you my covenant, and I'm renewing my covenant, even though you've messed up. right? I'm going to renew it, and I'm going to be faithful. Very significant, by the way, for Abram, who has just, you know, tried to achieve the covenant promises by his own efforts by fathering a son through Hagar. God says, no, no, I got this. Just believe me, trust me. People of Israel, Deuteronomy 29, 40 years of wilderness wanderings. All these people are dead and gone who the covenant was originally made with. No, no, God says, I got this. You're going to be fine as you enter in the promised land. So God's grace is seen in these verses, in these chapters. And the pattern is clear between Genesis and Exodus and following. Well, we continue on at the end of Genesis 17 into Genesis 18. And here we see God's promise to Abraham. I got to get used to saying Abraham now, because I've been trying to say Abram up to this point. God's promise to Abraham and Abraham's response. The most famous part of these chapters is the account of Sodom and also Gomorrah. That's what people often know. But actually, these chapters go together, chapters 18 and 19, and it's more than just Sodom and Gomorrah. There's some contrast made between Abraham and Lot in here. So let me just give you an overview of chapters 18 and 19. In the previous chapters, God had declared that Ishmael was not the promised son for Abraham. Rather, Sarah would deliver a child. In chapters 18 and 19, Moses demonstrates how God reassured Abraham and Sarah of these promises. Furthermore, these chapters show what happened to Abraham's other close family member, Lot. Lot would not be a part of God's covenant promises to the family of Abraham, but the people of Israel were to understand that Lot's descendants, the Ammonites and the Moabites, were to be left alone as they crossed into the land of promise. And finally, the text shows how God fulfilled his promise of blessing upon Abraham, and that Abraham's prayers are answered by God. Now, that's a mouthful, but let's just remind ourselves of what happens in chapters 18 and 19. Chapters 18, all of a sudden, Abraham has these three visitors that show up. Very clearly, one of those visitors is Yahweh, Jehovah. It's the Lord. The other two seem to be angels. And Abraham, you know, he has Sarah make, you know, a great presentation, huge amount of food. We'll talk about that in a moment. They're about to leave, and they declare to Abraham that, you know, something really bad is going to happen to Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham then pleads with Yahweh, the one who remains with him, Jehovah, pleads with him, you know, and he goes through that thing, you know, if there's 50 righteous people, would you spare the city? Yes, I'll spare them. If there's 40, if there's 30, and he keeps going down. Gets down to 10, and God promises that he would spare the city if there were even 10 righteous people. Of course, there weren't. You couldn't count on more than two hands the number of righteous people in Sodom. And after that, in chapter 19, we see the two angels going to Sodom. They go there, and they are treated very badly. We see the absolute depravity of Sodom on full display. Lot, remember, practically has to be dragged out of the city by the angels because he couldn't even convince his own family members to believe him that God's judgment was going to come upon there. Fire, brimstone, you know, rains down from heaven, destroys the cities of the plain. Lot's wife, she turns around, explicitly violating what God had said to not look back. She looks back. She has changed into a pillar of salt. And the last that we see of Lot is really just a horrific scene. I mean, chapter 19 is one, and I've used this line before. It's not original with me, but it's good. But there are some chapters in the Bible that you get done reading them, if you read them carefully and understand what's going on, you just want to take a bath when you're done, because it's just nasty all the way through. And chapter 19 is like that. At the end we see of Lot is he's in a cave in the mountains as an old man, having fled the city with his two daughters. And his two daughters are terrified that they're going to have no one to take care of them. And so they commit incest and get pregnant by their father, which creates the Ammonites and the Moabites. All right? Again, nasty. All right? So that's this whole chapter, these whole two chapters. Okay? What often gets emphasized is the Lot story and the Sodom and Gomorrah story, but actually there's a lot more going on, no pun intended. All right, didn't mean to say that. All right, there is more going on in that there are contrasts made between Abraham and Lot here. In fact, you see, I've given you a chart here, and this chart is not original with me. I've adapted it from Andrew Steinman's commentary on Genesis, which I've mentioned before, which I've found is a fairly recent publication, and I've been working my way through that as I've been rewriting these notes. I've looked at many other commentaries in the past. So far, in terms of accessibility and faithfulness to the text, this is one of my favorite commentaries out there, and it's fairly easy to read. Steinman has this helpful chart to show that how Genesis 18 and 19 have the same themes that are repeated over and over again. So you can see that you've got Abraham sitting, Lot sitting. Abraham goes to greet the three men. Lot stands to greet the two men because one of them remains behind with Abraham. Abraham bows, Lot bows. You have Abraham's invitation, Lot's invitation. Wash your feet, wash your feet. Then you can go. Tomorrow we'll go on your way. There's bread that's baked. This is an interesting comparison. Sarah laughs. We'll see this in a moment in verses 12, 13, and 15 of Genesis 18. Lot's would-be sons thought he was joking. The root word for joking is the same Hebrew word for laugh as well. There's the outcry against the city in both cases. There's the idea of they'll be swept away in chapters 18 and 19. There is a granting of requests with both Lot and Abraham, and there are also emphases about destroying the city in both. So there, I think this indicates that Moses is trying to see that these two chapters are intimately connected, and we see two very different responses between Abraham and Lot. Now, when I say that people focus on Sodom and Gomorrah and they forget all the other things, it doesn't mean I want to diminish or dismiss the significance of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's a very significant event in the Old Testament, and that's emphasized by Ezekiel picking up on it in Ezekiel 16. But sometimes we might, because it's so bad or, you know, it's like clickbait, it's easy to see that and miss what else is going on as Moses tells and gives this account. So let's talk about what happens in chapters 18 and 19. Well, first of all, we have the visit of the three strangers to Abraham in verses 1 through 33. That's chapter 18. And you can divide that into two parts. In part 1, you again have the renewal of a promise of a son to Abraham and Sarah. This keeps coming up over and over again. The God's promise is the key in these texts. And we see that as he makes this promise again to Abraham and to Sarah. There's a trio of people. It's made up by Yahweh, Jehovah, that is. You can see that in verse 22. So if you actually go down to chapter 18 and verse 22, we see that explicitly stated. So the men turned from there and went towards Sodom, but Abraham stood still before the Lord. And if you notice in your Bible, that's capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. That is the name for Jehovah or Yahweh. So this is God. There's also two angels. So two of the three leave, and you can see that in chapter 19 and verse 1. So the appearance of Yahweh is like that of his appearance to Hagar in chapter 16. The fancy word here is we say this is a Christophany. You see that word Christ, which means this is likely the Son of God appearing in the form of an angel before his incarnation. Probably better stated, just thinking about this, in this case, he appeared as the form of a man before his incarnation. Abraham, as these men approach him, he immediately recognizes these guys are significant. Now, we're not told how he knows that, but he knows it, right? And you see that in his response. He offers an immense amount of food to these guests. So when you read in verses 6 through 8, where it says, you know, quick, three seahs of fine flour, knead it and make cakes. Hey, ladies, look at the equivalent of today. That's about 21 quarts or 20 liters of flour. Quick, do that at age 90, lady, you know. Let's get on that. Chop, chop, all right? Now, it was probably not just Sarah who was doing all the work here. I mean, there was a whole household of people. But this was an immense production. You have a whole calf that's slaughtered. And so this is, and a ram as well, or a calf, excuse me, that's slaughtered. So there is a lot that happens here. So obviously Abraham recognizes that these men were very significant. We also see that it's clearly God who is in operation here, because it's Yahweh, it's God. Let her see that no Sarah is listening into his conversation. So after they make this food, we see this in Genesis 18, verse 9. The men said to him, that's Abraham, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And he said, Abraham says, she's in the tent. She's not here, she's in the tent. And the Lord said, "I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son." And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Okay? And we get very clearly that these men knew that was going on. And God knows this is going on. And God, because God is going to read Sarah's thoughts. Now that he gives this promise to Abraham, this is the most specific promise that God has given. Remember that in chapter 17 it says, you know, about this time next year in about a year you'll have a son. Now we get this even more specifically here, that you will have a son next year. Very, very specific. That these are no mere men, as I mentioned, is made clear to Abraham when Yahweh could read the thoughts of Sarah. I guess I kind of went out of order there. I apologize. Sarah's response is to laugh to herself in verse 12, and God's response is to ask a powerful question. And this question, by the way, is just, it's a fantastic question. It would have spoke well to Abraham and to Sarah. It would have spoke well to the people of Israel as they're getting ready to cross over over the Jordan into the land of promise. And it speaks well to us as Christians today. Is there anything impossible for the Lord? Is there anything too hard for the Lord? And this text demonstrates that the answer is no. In verse number 15, we see a confrontation that in verses 13 through 15 between the angels and Sarah. In her mind, you know, Sarah laughs. She says to herself in verse 12, "After I'm worn out and my Lord is old, shall I have pleasure?" The Lord says to Abraham, and by the way, just so you know, that's a metaphor. I mean, that's a pretty clear statement that they weren't regularly having intimate times at this stage of their life. All right, that's way past. So we're not even engaging in that anymore. Like, how in the world are we going to have a kid? I mean, that's what that's saying. And so she's laughing in her mind. We also see at the end of verse 11 that the way of women had ceased to be with her. Right, her cycle is not happening anymore. There's no babies coming here. Okay, that's the key. But God confronts Abraham, really Sarah through Abraham, when he says in verse 13, "Why did Sarah laugh and say, 'Shall I indeed bear a child now that I'm old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I'm going to give you this son.'" And then verse 15, it's interesting. Sarah denies this, saying, "I did not laugh, for she was afraid." And Yahweh, Jehovah, says, you did laugh. Now, how could God possibly know that unless how could this man, possibly know that unless he was more than just a man? So I would tentatively suggest, and I tentatively suggest that in verse 15, we actually begin to see the building of faith in Sarah, though it is mixed with sin. She lied, but she feared. At this point, she recognized the angel of the Lord could read her mind. That had to have been a terrifying moment. Right? And I think this leads to what the author of Hebrews would say in Hebrews 12, that she received strength and was able to bear a child. Right? And I'm not trying to be like, you know, biology 101 here, but obviously they resumed relations after apparently not having them for a while, which was, in some sense, a real act of faith. And a child was born. So Sarah, in this, is confronted by God, and she recognizes what God, who this was. Now, part two of these visit of the three strangers to Abraham is Abraham's pleading. Abraham pleads for Sodom. God's question in verse number 17 as to whether he would hide from Abraham what I'm doing demonstrates that Abraham was the friend of God. That's said in Isaiah 41. In general, Verses 17 through 29 emphasize God's covenant status bestowed upon Abraham. Abraham's friendship with God is also confirmed by his ability to negotiate with God. So this is a status that is given upon Abraham that we just, you know, quite frankly, don't have right now, you know, to be able to push back against God and, you know, what about this, what about that, what about this? Not in the same way. It's an astounding thing. Abraham, in this negotiation with God, believes in God's justice. This is his basis for pleading for Sodom and Gomorrah in verse 25. The question, shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just, helps define God's actions in both bringing judgment upon Sodom and Gomorrah, but also God's sparing of Lot and his family. Abraham believed in the justice of God. And of course, you have that great interchange between Abraham and God. The classic question is, why did Abraham not keep going from 10 further down? I think, you know, I don't know. My guess would be is he probably assumed, oh, there's at least 10. Lot's there. He's got kids. How sad it was not true. How sad it was not true. That's just my speculation. Well, then in chapter 19... We turn the page and we the script moves on here. We see the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah, but also the mercy extended towards Lot. You know, in general, as I mentioned, this is just a nasty chapter. The wickedness of Sodom is graphically displayed in this chapter. You know, the inhabitants of Sodom were particularly immoral, including indulging in homosexuality, what we call sodomy today. The extent of the perversion is highlighted by the fact that it was practiced from the young to the old. And therefore, this sin was generational. It's generational. Lot, his wife, and daughters only escape thanks to the miraculous intervention of the angels. And I've taught on this passage other times, but you just read through it and you just see how bad these people are. You know, you have two visitors that come in the city, and the first thing that the men of the city, from the young and the old, want to do is to engage in homosexual relationships with them, and they were willing to force that to happen. You just think about a city that was given over to that level of perversion and abuse. That's the word here that we're talking about. It's abuse. Sodom's sin was not just the evil of homosexuality. And we see that, by the way, in the prophet Ezekiel. You can read this on your own time in Ezekiel 16, 48 through 50. But in general, Ezekiel states that the sins of Sodom included pride, fullness of food, abundance of idleness, and a refusal to strengthen the hand of the poor and needy, and furthermore, a haughty desire to commit abomination before God, which was the homosexuality. So clearly that was a sin. But note there that in Ezekiel's mind and in God's mind, there were a whole host of other sins that went along with this. So we could summarize it this way, that Sodom was a rich and wealthy city which was willing to indulge their every passion. And they were willing to do whatever it took to get those passions indulged. This sense of unbridled passion is seen when the men are willing to not only sexually abuse the visitors to their own city, but also the daughters of Lot. You remember that? That Lot, I mean, it's just horrifying of how far Lot had vexed his soul, to use the words of Peter here. And that he was willing to say to the men of the city, let these guys stay in my house, take my two daughters, you can use them. Like that's just mind-blowing how bad that is. That should give you a picture of just how evil that entire city, that whole region was. Incidentally, this is for free. You know, some people wonder about how is it merciful, how can a merciful God bring that kind of judgment upon all, a whole city? Young and old, and everywhere in between. And sometimes I think the answer is the depravity of man, when it goes far enough, in order for God to stop it, he has to start over. And this is not the first time we see this in Genesis. That's essentially what God does in the flood. And I do think that is what sometimes God does even today with nations and people groups of the earth. It's like he will not let that go far. Eventually, it's like this is going to stop. So there's an utter destruction. We see the same kind of thing is going to happen, by the way, for the people of Israel as they crossed over in the land of Canaan. Whole people groups were to be destroyed because their evil was just absolutely great. And when you have generational sin that just keeps advancing like that, there has to be some way to stop it. And this was the way to stop it. In that sense, it's an actual mercy, because if God, what if God had let Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities of the plain continue to exercise that kind of depravity? How bad would have things gotten? You know, so you think about, yes, it's terrible when we think about whole cities wiped out, but it's also terrible to think about if you were just passing by those cities and you were going to be abused in that way. Like, how in the world would that be merciful if God let that go on? So just chew on that. That's free. That's not in the notes. But you do have that thought to think through in Genesis 19. We've already mentioned the end of Lot's story. It's the last time the story speaks of him, and it is horrifically sad. His sons-in-law remained in unbelief, perished in the burning of the city. You know, they thought dad-in-law was kidding. His wife, who was curious at the very least, no doubt too attached to the world, is transformed into a pillar of salt for having looked back. It's true that that was her decision and it was her sin. And I have to imagine that part of that was she's grieving over the fact that her daughters, who are married to her sons-in-law, were going to be in that destroyed. But you see also really the sin of Lot in pitching his tent first towards Sodom, and then he's in the gate and it's the city of Sodom on display. Of course, then we also mention his two daughters commit incest with him without his knowledge. Lot is made drunk in that whole situation. These peoples that would come from Lot would later afflict Abraham's descendants. And these are people that Abraham's descendants knew well, Moses and his generation knew well. This, again, is a sign of the purpose of Genesis. It shows God's call to Israel to set her apart from the nations around her. Of course, we do read in 2 Peter that Lot was a righteous man. His soul was vexed. He didn't appreciate all of the sin. And there's a lot of lessons to be drawn there, most of them tragic. But we also see, interestingly, at the second half of Genesis 19, that God's blessing was upon Abraham. In verse 29, God remembered Abraham and therefore spared Lot. That's a pretty stunning statement. So even the blessing of Lot being spared was because of Abraham's pleas toward God. This again indicates both the power of prayer, but it also indicates God's faithfulness to his promises. Abraham had been set apart by God's grace as a person that God was going to work through, and we see that demonstrated here. All right, Genesis 20 into 21. And here we find, finally, we get to the promised son. Abraham receives the promised son. This section tells of Abraham's two sons, Isaac and Ishmael. Surrounding, though, these accounts of the two sons is Abraham's interactions with Abimelech, or Abimelech in Hebrew. Abimelech represents, and I'll talk about that in a moment, Abimelech represents a serious threat to God's promises to Abraham. Ishmael also represents a threat to God's promises. God's gracious will is demonstrated in these two chapters in order that God's covenant promises might come to pass. And we see that displayed in a number of ways. Well, we begin with Abraham moving toward the Negev. You see that in verse number, let me get to it here. Negev or Negev, I think on New King James and King James, is it the wilderness? Is that what it says? What does it say there in verse 1? Oh, it says the south in the New King James?
South.
What is it? Does anybody have a King James? Is it wilderness? South country in the King James? Okay. So the word is Negev or the Negeb. That is in the southern part of Israel. It's a very wildernessy area, not lush. We might speculate as to why he did that. My personal best guess is after you just watched the whole plains of Sodom and Gomorrah get wiped out, it wasn't really a place you wanted to hang around for a while. I don't know that, but that would be my guess. He moves, but in his move, and by the way, this was not like when he moved out of the land of promise to Egypt. This is part of the land of promise. It still exists today. It's, if you go to Israel, the tour guides don't take you there, all right, because there's nothing to see. But actually, a number of significant events did take place in the life of Israel in this wilderness area, included David, who fled there from Saul. He's in this area, and he encounters this king, Abimelech, and he does this sin again where he lies about his wife to Abimelech. Just in passing, we need to note that the Abimelech mentioned in these verses is not the same as that end of chapter 26. The name Abimelech means my father is king. Because remember, Isaac is going to have the same problem. He's going to run with Abimelech here. It may have been a popular family name for this dynasty of kings or a specific throne name for the kings of Gerar. Now, this is also for free. When you read the account of Gideon, remember that Gideon is told that after he leads the victory against the Midianites, you know, with his 300 men, and they want, you remember what they want to make of him? They want to make him king. And he says, no, I'm not going to be king. I'm not going to be king. Well, the next thing you see is actually of him being dressed in kingly garb. He's wearing gold and all kinds of stuff. And then he names his son Abimelech. Abimelech. Melech is the word for king. Abi is the word for father. So I'm not going to be king, but I'm going to name my son. My father is king. All right, that's what he does. So in this case, Abimelech was probably, for the people of Gerar, a name that was given to all the first sons of the throne. My father is king, and my son will also be named Abimelech because his father is king, and so on. So not the same guy. It's about 90 years separation between here and what you see with Isaac. Of course, Abraham relapses, number two, by lying again in order to protect himself from people who would covet his wife. The result is once again a king taking Sarah into his harem. God's graciousness towards Abimelech is seen in verse 6 in that God did not allow him to touch Sarah. This spares Abimelech's life. And this is also an aspect of God's grace, even towards people who are not believers. The result of Abraham's lie was as potentially disastrous as his first lie to Pharaoh in Egypt. Remember, at this point, you follow the timeline where what's happening here. Sarah would have either been newly pregnant or was about to become pregnant. If God had not intervened and Abraham had not received pledges from the king of Gerar, people could have thought and said that Isaac was the son of Abimelech rather than Abraham. As that's the picture, she's being taken into his harem. By the way, that indicates Sarah apparently was pretty good looking at 90, all right? So she's, all right.
I would say.
Yeah. So do with that what you will, all right? But people could have said that about her, all right? But fortunately here, we see that God is faithful even when we are unfaithful. God is faithful even when we are unfaithful. And you can see that principle in the New Testament here. It's also interesting that when you read this, the blessing of Abraham, God's blessing of Abraham, is once again displayed when it is Abraham in verses 17 through 18 who prays and God answers his prayer. That's stunning, by the way. Abraham sins against the Lord by lying again about his wife after God in the last several chapters has demonstrated clearly that he is faithful to his promises. He still goes out and sins, and yet God still answers Abraham's prayer. There's probably a good lesson for all of us in that as well. And you know, we probably should stop right there and be done. We'll pick it up next time with the birth of Isaac and get to finish up our interaction with Abimelech here at the end of chapter 21. All right, we will be dismissed and get ready for the morning worship service.